This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Week in Review on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that puts the media and the news in the spotlight. This week we chart the challenges in store for the Malaysian media in 2015. But before that, we have three stories from Asia Calling. Philippines, the new call center capital of the world. A North Korean refugee aspires to be a hip-hop star. And in India, protesters kiss in public to oppose moral policing. The Philippines has overtaken India as the new call center capital of the world. This means that when you're on the phone to a call center, you are most likely talking to a Filipino agent. Jofel Tosorio has the story.
The Philippines is now the new destination of choice for international companies wanting to outsource their call center.
Thank you for calling. This is Katrina. How can I help you? Well, that's great. Have you heard about our value package?
In a room lined with rows of computers, everyone is busy with their headsets, answering phone calls from other parts of the globe. They're working all night long, while everybody else is asleep.
Thank you for that information, Mr. Do. How may I help you today?
Diana Kleiberg, a lecturer from the University of Amsterdam, explains the advantage of using Filipino call center agents.
The main attraction, I think, lies in the fact that there's a very large, talented workforce that is English-speaking, and English-speaking with an accent that's very understandable, especially for North Americans. So that's one thing. The second thing is that the workforce is also well-educated, which makes it easy to transfer service-based tasks. And there's a cultural affinity with North America that also helps in communicating and performing customer services.
Rory Sachs is the general manager of a US-based company, PCM. He says the company has a largely young and well-educated workforce.
So you know you have a base of strength from individuals who have studied so many different disciplines and are willing to give the talents they learn, and they have the communication that relates to wherever the companies are coming from and based, Australia, Europe. I use the English countries, England, Ireland, and of course, you know, my roots in the United States.
Okay, well, there are just a few things that I need to let you know. In the future, if you switch or remove any of your channels or packages, there may be a...
The call center industry in the Philippines is now the third largest dollar earner after tourism and remittances. With a salary of at least $400 a month, the industry employs nearly 800,000 workers. 24-year-old Maria Concepcion Andres is a graduate of communication arts. She joined the call center industry 4 years ago.
To be quite honest, it's really the pay. Kasi parang sa na-experience ko before, pag local job talaga.
To be quite honest, it's really for the pay. From what I experienced before with local jobs, they give you a very low salary, and the benefits are not very competitive. Foreign companies that are based here give better benefits, so I'd prefer to work for them than for local companies.
But it comes with a great deal of stress, says one of the call center workers, Luis de Lestrico.
First of all, sleeping during daytime because you need to work at nighttime. And then another thing is the customer itself, because there are some customers that are irate and you need a lot of patience for yourself, especially, for example, the customer is already swearing you, giving you profane languages.
There are health consequences as a result, says Leon Marisigan, a researcher on labor issues at the University of the Philippines.
It's the nature of the work. You answer calls all the time. So you get, there are adverse health impacts of that on the throat, for example. And then, of course, you also deal with irate customers most of the time because this is customer service.
Convergys is the flag bearer in sacrifice, being able...
This advertisement from a leading call center company describes their workers as the new breed of heroes for sacrificing their family and social life to contribute to the country's economy and their family's welfare.
Thank you.
Unusual working hours means having fun at strange times of the day. It's 9 in the morning, and Rory Zaks is bowling after work with his colleagues.
I come to work at 10 at night. I stay all night like everybody else, and I'll work as it doesn't. But like I said, you and I are going to cut off this discussion in a few minutes because I'm going to go to sleep.
With the real Carlos from Manila, Philippines, this is Joe Feltisorio for Asia Calling.
South Korea has a vibrant hip-hop scene. There's even an American Idol-like show where rappers compete in hopes of getting picked by music producers. Recently, there was a contestant on a show unlike any other. He's a refugee from North Korea. And it's fair to say that most South Koreans have never heard lyrics like his before. Jason Struthers speaks to the aspiring rapper.
While growing up in North Korea, Kang Chung-hyuk remembers listening to bands like the Ponchambo Electronic Ensemble, which put out songs that sound like this. Now at age 28 and living below the border, Kang writes his own music, but it's nothing like what he heard back home. He flips through the pages of his notebook and gives me a sample.
Yeah. 내 나이 29, 한국 생활 언더 12년, 절망 속에 갇혀 몸부림 치던 그 땅에서도 12년.
In this rap, he says his first 12 years of life in North Korea were terrible. He says that while the ruling Kim family drank expensive imported booze, he was eating tree bark and drinking out of mud puddles. Kang says it's these memories of life during North Korea's deadly famine in the 1990s that inspire his lyrics the most.
I was starving when I was a kid. I had to steal food. Yeah, I'm angry about that. Why did I have to live like that?
Before his family escaped North Korea in 1998, Kang grew up as a street child. He only had the chance to learn about playing music and the arts once he arrived in the South 3 years later. Refugee advocates say for people like Kang, who grew up outside of the capital Pyongyang, those opportunities just don't exist. That's according to Roland Chi, who is with the Citizens Alliance for North Korean Human Rights, a refugee support group in Seoul.
They've been sort of brainwashed. Any sort of artistic compunction that they have has been stamped out of them, unless it's directed towards glorifying the state of North Korea.
Chi says when Kang first came here, they noticed he had a knack for drawing. He's now about to graduate from one of Korea's top art schools. Rapping is a new talent he's working on. So far, he's written 4 songs, but he's already made his South Korean television debut. Kang was recently a contestant on Show Me the Money, a reality program that gives aspiring rappers a chance to stand in the limelight. He says going on the show was a great experience, but he realized that compared to most other South Korean rappers, the music he's writing is very different.
I know people here have lived under tough times too, but it's hard to compare to how North Koreans live. South Koreans write love songs and about breaking up, but I'm writing lyrics about human rights.
For many South Korean viewers, Kang's appearance on the show might have been the first time they've ever heard a North Korean defector speak, let alone rap, about human rights or life back in the North. And it left an impression on some of the program's judges, too. The Quiet is a South Korean rapper and producer. He says he was surprised about Kang's lyrics when he first heard him perform.
Yeah, it was serious. Yeah, I never heard about that kind of rapper, you know?
The Quiet explains that many South Koreans just don't care about North Korea or the 26,000-plus defectors who now live here. But he thinks if Kang keeps working at it and puts out songs, he might be able to change minds.
There are many things that we don't know. So, he can tell it. So, yeah, he should do it. is important.
But he says Kang Chun-hyuk needs to get over some stage fright first. He was eliminated from Show Me the Money after he choked and forgot his lyrics. But now, Kang's getting some help from Korean-American composer and producer Woody Pak.
And I was struck by the way his words are really reflecting what he can't, is probably too shy to say in a normal conversation. As we continue to work, I hope that he finds a lot of freedom and inspiration, and that he's inspired by the fact that he can express himself freely and get a message out there.
Pak and Kang have so far made it into the studio to work on one song. It starts off like this. Even though we grew up differently, we are still brothers. Even though the 38th parallel blocks us, we are still one. And now look around, we are standing here together in the big Seoul city.
Everyone likes music. I hope through my songs that I can not only tell people more about myself, but also tell the real story about North Korea.
Kang hopes to have his first album out by December. For Asia Calling, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
Unhappy with rampant moral policing in India, a section of its citizens have decided to protest with a symbolic gesture, hugging and kissing in public. This follows beatings of people displaying affection in public by Hindu nationalist groups. Bismillah Gilani observes the protests.
Outside a metro rail station in Delhi, hundreds of young men and women sit in a circle. One by one, couples stand up, hug, and then start kissing. They then marched to the office of the Hindu nationalist group Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh or RSS. This group often harasses young couples in places like parks, restaurants and beaches. At times they use violence to stop what they see as immoral intimacy. 30-year-old Rajesh Kumar says they have no right to do this.
How can you stop something as harmless as kissing in public spaces? We think that kissing in public spaces is not offensive at all. It is definitely not a part of Western culture that we are taking in. It is definitely a part of Indian culture also. And we think that when the constitution allows this, we do not want any non-constitutional body to violently stop us. Yeah. So we are actually using the kiss as a metaphor for non-violent protest.
Dozens of Hindu activists come out of the RSS office. They try to break up the kissing couples and start hitting some of them. Abhishek Mishra leads the group.
We are not against love, but you can't do all these things in public. This is against our culture. If you want to kiss, go do it at home.
The Kiss of Love campaign began in the southern state of Kerala after Hindu activists from the RSS attacked a coffee shop and beat up couples who were there. A group of students launched an online campaign, urging people to kiss in public in protest. Hundreds of people responded, but in Kerala, the police cracked out, arresting more than 50 protesters. But this hasn't stopped the kissing protest from spreading to all major cities in India. Hindu religious leader Vivek Virat sees it as a foreign-funded conspiracy to morally corrupt the Indian society.
If a child demands something that is not good for him, we try to make him understand that it is not good for him. If he insists, then we scold him or even hit him. The people behind the campaign are trying to convince the young generations that they are free and can do anything they want. It has already done a lot of damage. This is a conspiracy against the Hindu society and our value system, and it cannot be tolerated.
Back at the protest site in New Delhi, the police have intervened, detaining some of the people from both sides and dispersing others. 25-year-old Shalini is watching.
You don't get to see love these days. You do see a lot of violence. I don't see anything wrong with someone going out of their way to propose to someone publicly or hugging and kissing.
From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio Anamlapanha in Jakarta. Next up, we take a look at the challenges for the Malaysian media in 2015. I'm Sharad Kutan, and you're listening to The Week in Review, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, and The Week in Review continues. Last week, we had a look at the challenges the media faced in 2014. This week, we ask editors, journalists and commentators what they think will be the major challenges for the media this year, 2015. It's often forgotten by those who consume media that it's both the fourth estate, that central pillar of a democratic society, but also a business. It is a fact that media owners and practitioners can hardly ignore. CEO and co-founder of Malaysiakini, Premesh Chandran, outlines the realities that media organizations face as businesses.
It's been a very challenging environment for many number of years. And I think, you know, Malaysia is actually, you know, brewing. I think traditional media are having a very tough time competing with new media, internet media, etc. Obviously, 2014 was a very tough year in terms of advertising revenues. Advertising revenues, I think, were not as strong as previously. I think 2015 will also be difficult in terms of advertising. So the current business model which supports media is not questionable. So I see a lot of resizing among media companies. I think that's the norm. We also had changes at Rev Asia, which is, you know, also about a print and online company. So I think that, you know, there generally is going to be some shake-up in terms of the media industry.
Beyond the question of the business of media and its position in the market is the question of how each media organization deals with various stakeholders, such as the government and social groups. Leslie Lau is executive editor of the Malay Mail Online.
I think in its purest form, media is basically a platform to report what is happening in the country, whether it's air crash or whether it's a trend, what are we eating today, you know? And it's really for the public to decide and set that kind of agenda. The media should basically be looked at as a platform in its purest form. That's my opinion. Of course, we do run opinion pieces and commentaries and do take a stand now and then. But generally, that agenda is for the public to set. What kind of country you want the country to be, it's not for the media to say. The most important thing is that the media should provide adequate information from all sides. So when there is adequate information, the public can decide what it wants to do. Politicians can set policy based on that. But when going back to things like the Sedition Act, just like to bring that in, that would actually stifle any kind of debate. There's always been an argument that if the things are too sensitive, we don't talk about it. I always like to draw a bit of a parallel to families. You know, families frequently, your father, your mother will say, don't talk about it, it's very sensitive. And you know what happens then when everyone doesn't talk about anything? What happens then is that resentment grows. And that can be seen in society when people are told not to debate an issue, or if you bring it back to the MH370 story, if there is some problem that is embarrassing or there's an issue and we don't talk about it, we talk about a nationalist agenda instead, what happens? You know, you're keeping information away from the public. I think that we should treat everyone like adults. We should try to behave like adults. We should debate ideas in the media and so on and so forth, and not just debate ideas from a standpoint that I must get my way. Yeah.
There is a diversity of opinion in the media about the relationship media organizations should have vis-a-vis the government. These opinions affect story choice and news agendas. Anwar Mansur is a journalist with Utusan Malaysia Online. He thinks that the media should act as a bridge between government and the public.
I always believe that the media is the one who's got the Malay world yang akan memastikan government melakukan apa yang patut government buat. Okay? For example, when Prime Minister announced the budget for 2015, right, the duty of the media to sampaikan to the public, what are the benefits of this budget being presented? How can the public take advantage from the budget being presented? What are the effects that the budget is going to have on everything in the country? That is what the media should do. I'm not saying totally support. I'm saying that the role of the media should be as the one who reminds the government, okay, this is what you should do. This is what you should not do. If you go all out and bash all the government every single minute of the day, right, whatever the government do is wrong. Then when are the people going to have something right?
The government has promised to strengthen the Sedition Act in 2015. How will it affect the media? Jahba Sadiq, CEO of the Malaysian Insider, argues that the alternative media will face the brunt of the law.
It will have an adverse effect, I think, on the independent journalists, online media. It won't affect the newspapers or television stations because they generally agree with what the government says and does, right? There's not much, you're not going to get a revolution or a contrarian mindset from the broadcast or the print media.
Zaram Naim is Professor of Media and Communication Studies at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. He thinks the media should not be cowed by the prospect of a strengthened Sedition Act.
Sure, people say there is a Sedition Act as well. But as far as I know, with the Sedition Act, at least you can challenge it in court, right? And I think we'll challenge it in court. I don't think people should feel fearful about speaking up. And I think there is a need to speak up, especially when hateful groups are given so much space. I think there is a need to counter them, right? Malaysians are more aware of things now. Malaysians are more conscious of the need to be rational and debate things, right? Yeah, sure, there's groups who want to cut down debate, cut down discussion. But I don't think we should fall into that trap and be fearful of them, right?
Traditional media has long lamented the relative freedom that the net-based alternative media have had. But as Jahba noted, this might prove to be a disadvantage if screws are tightened using the Sedition Act. Malaysia Kini's Premish wants laws covering traditional media to be relaxed, but is pessimistic of it happening soon.
I think the law as it stands, especially with regards to traditional media, still remains very restrictive. And also, you know, to do with online media, obviously you have things like Sedition Act and the Office Secrets Act and other acts. So I think, you know, if the country wants to move forward, if you want to battle corruption, want to introduce more transparency, then the government has to decide to open up the traditional media. But by the looks of it, the government's not headed in that direction. In fact, there may be a tendency to be more conservative and start to introduce new restrictions on media itself.
For some, a new year brings renewed hope. We asked those who we spoke to what they would like to see in 2015. Malay Mail Online's Leslie Lau wants space for ideas to be discussed.
I mentioned earlier that people are beginning to stand up for what they believe in. And I think people should continue doing that. In cases like the Sedition Act, even though the government has reversed its decision to repeal it, people who believe that the law should not stand should continue their fight for it, legally, of course. As I said, there should be a battle of ideas, and I think people should start getting used, the public should start getting used to the idea of debating ideas, debating it, coming out and debating all the ideas, whether it's in the media, and have this battle of ideas. The country can only become better, okay, when we really debate ideas. If we stifle ideas, that's not going to happen. So that's really the immediate struggle in the coming new year, I think. I think people have to realize that, and they can't depend on political parties. You shouldn't just draw a line and stand behind whether it's Barisan Nasional or Pakatan Rakyat or whatever political party you support. You should do it yourself. You should stand up, do it yourself. I think the recent stand by the so-called eminent 25 persons standing up for so-called moderate stance in the country, I think that's a really good development. Unfortunately, it's in the domain of the English-speaking, rather more middle class, okay? But it's a start. It's not going to change anything overnight. I applaud, in fact, some people may disagree with me, I applaud groups like Perkasa and ISMA from the standpoint they're making a stand for what they believe in. So if people don't agree with Perkasa and ISMA, just keep quiet and expect their political leaders or their MPs to do it. Well, it's not going to happen. You've got to make a stand yourself as well. My wish for New Year that people will have a more mature approach. That means when you debate an idea, you should try and convince the other side rather than just hurl insults at each other. Hurling insults at each other is what children in the playground do. But if you are a grown-up, and I think we should all aspire to be grown-ups, we should try to convince the other party that our ideas may be right and also possibly be open to ideas from the other side.
Jahba Sadiq from the Malaysian Insider hopes practitioners will sharpen their journalistic skills.
I think for 2015, we need media practitioners, journalists who are a lot more curious, a lot more inquisitive, a lot braver. And I think we're getting there. We're having a set of young people who dare to ask any question and every question, who will not wilt in the face of authority, who are courageous enough to be inquisitive and investigative about the goings-on of their country.
Media should also be the voice of the public in exposing issues that matter to them, says Anwar Manso of Utusan Malaysia Online.
Well, get more engaged with the people.
I mean, of course, that's the media, right? What we report will always affect the public. Okay, take one case, for example. Remember the group of kids who did the Tampa Jalan thingy? I think a few weeks back, right? These kind of things happen, okay? Just for example, the road in most part of the country are quite, like, need more attention to be given to. But then, every time when the public says something, it's going to take, like, forever for the relevant party to do something about it, be it in a country governed by the government or be it in a state governed by the opposition. One example that I could give is that there's an accident that I saw last 2 weeks. The accident happened because of the road. The road has been, I think they're trying to upgrade the road, but there's no sign, there's no proper maintenance on the road. And I was told that there's already 5 accidents happened on that stretch of road, but nobody's doing nothing about it. After people start to share a video of an accident on that road, then only we can see that they finish up the road within 24 hours. Now, this is the role of the media. Okay, when we got engaged with the public, right, sampaikan what the public want to sampai to the relevant party, be it government, be it the opposition. When this kind of thing being conveyed to the relevant party, we can see action taken. When action is taken, then to have a better situation for the country is not a problem. And the media, for me, be it mainstream, be it alternative, right, should really stop talking about racial things, ketidakadilan dalam soal agama. This is bullshit, right? For me, I came from Kelantan. We have no problem, be it racial, be it religion. Not a problem at all. This is the thing that we should highlight.
Malaysia Kini's Premish concurs with Anwar.
I think we can also do a more wider coverage about what's really going on within the grassroots, you know, within communities nationwide. I think we can, you know, better cover issues such as health, dengue, you know, income issues, sustainable living issues. I think Malaysians are facing cash crunch and income crunch. And I think often this level of the issue is actually does not become a hot issue, a major issue in the media. So I think we could do a better balance between short-term explosive issues, which capture headlines, and longer-term, you know, more grassroots issues, which perhaps are not as hot as fancy, but are equally important to the country. I think engaging and focusing on issues which are affecting a lot of people, sometimes some of these issues don't get as much coverage as they should.
Equal access to information and a diversity of media remains a problem. This is especially true for rural populations. Zarum Naim points to the language and class dimensions of the problem.
I think there are signs that things are improving in that sense, that different alternative viewpoints are being voiced. But I think we must remember that much of these alternative viewpoints are in one language, that is the English language. Yeah? There is still a need to work on the national language and to work on the spread of the news in the national language as well, especially to outlying areas and also to Sabah and Sarawak. Or else the enlightened groups will only be the middle-class, Western-educated, English-educated groups, whereas then you'll have one group that has information surplus, the other group will have information deficit. So that's when you'll have that kind of imbalance. That is, I think that's very dangerous for democracy. So there is a need, I guess, for all who are concerned about greater news sources and greater news, variety of news, to think in terms of expanding the boundaries, so to speak. Yeah.
That was Zarum Naim, Professor of Media and Communication Studies at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. We hope the new year brings more clarity about the challenges the media faces and strategies to keep information flowing and dialogue open throughout 2015. We would like to thank Anwar Manso of Utusan Malaysia Online, Leslie Lau of the Malay Mail Online, Jahaba Sadiq of the Malaysian Insider, Malaysia Kini's Premish Chandran and Zarum Naim from the University of Nottingham, Malaysia for their contributions to this morning's show. I hope the show has been food for thought. And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. That's all we have for the Week in Review. I'm Sharad Kutin for BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.